This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Kristen Bringle, Director of Legislative and Government Relations at the National Parks Conservation Association. Kristen Bringle is here today to tell us about threats to our national parks, as well as opportunities to protect and enhance our parks, both now and in the future. Welcome, Kristen.
Thank you for having me.
Would you begin by saying a few words about the National Parks Conservation Association?
Sure. We're one of the oldest conservation groups in the country. We work to advocate on behalf of the national parks for the public to make sure they're well preserved and protected for future generations. And we have about 22 offices throughout the country. So we're embedded right outside of some national parks. And we also have our headquarters back here in D.C. where I'm located, where we speak directly with our government officials and Congress and try to make sure that parks remain well-funded and protected.
Would you give a brief overview of the current status of our national parks in the U.S.?
Well, I always like to start off by telling people to go visit them and enjoy them because they are amazing places and sites that everyone should take advantage of because you own them. They are publicly owned. So definitely go enjoy them. And, you know, you go to Grand Canyon or Yellowstone or near my house, Fort McHenry, and they're wonderful places to take your family. So I don't want to discourage people from going there based on some of the threats that are happening to them. They are just wonderful natural treasures and also wonderful historic sites. But there are things happening to our national parks that the public is extremely aware of, from climate change impacts to wildfires to invasive species taking over river corridors to historic buildings crumbling because we're not sufficiently funding the care of them. So whereas the parks are just some of the most beautiful places in the country, we also aren't doing our best job of taking care of them because of issues of funding and lack of funding and not being able to hire the staff to really maintain them.
How widely used are our national parks?
About 300 million visitors go to our national parks, and we have 401 national park units spread all over the country. It used to be in every state but Delaware, but Delaware recently had a new park unit added, so now we cover all of the states and some of the territories. And we have both American visitors and international visitors. In fact, sometimes you go to the national parks in Utah, where I like to go a lot, and you hear a lot of German. So we have many visitors from all over the world. And really, we had the first national park in the entire world, Yellowstone, designated, and people flock to these places and really love them.
Would you go into detail now about the funding issues for parks? How does today's funding compare with previous years?
It's been on the decline for the last 3 years, so it's troubling. With the recession happening and just federal funding declining in every department across the federal government, parks have just been sort of a casualty of funding declines. But in addition to that, with the sequester kicking in earlier this year, the funding has declined even more. So we are looking at pretty much a 13% reduction in park funding in just in the last 3 years. And this really hurts because the majority of park funding goes towards staff. So everything from the rangers that you meet at the visitor kiosks to the water quality specialists in the park, this dramatic funding decrease means that we have fewer people taking care of these places and directing visitors to trails and attractions. So it really does hurt the park system incredibly when we can't get it the funding that it needs to run.
How is reduced funding affecting ecosystem protection within the parks?
This is sort of troubling because you don't hear about this in the newspapers and on the news all the time, but due to the funding decreases, the Park Service has basically not been able to hire about 900 full-time positions, and this includes people like water quality specialists in the Everglades, where the park is underwater and it's really critical to maintain water quality there, but we can't hire a water quality specialist down there right now because the Park Service doesn't have the funds to do it. So everything from that type of very specific expertise that we need to just having enough rangers out there helping to direct staff or helping to direct visitors and to make sure that we're adequately protecting certain resources and taking care of wildlife and staying on track with making sure that we're monitoring wildlife in the parks to make sure they're well protected too while people go to visit these places. So there are real sort of both quality control impacts, having librarians at certain park units there to answer people's questions and to maintain our exhibits within different park units. So people will start to notice probably this year the difference in staffing levels because there are fewer ranger tours and fewer people actually taking care of some of the units.
To what extent have there been shutdowns in visitor centers and fewer weeks that you can go to a campground?
Definitely the hours for many visitor centers have been more restrictive, so they're closing earlier. Some visitor centers are only open 5 days a week instead of seven. Before the sequester hit, many park units were saying that they would have to shut down some visitor centers entirely, but in some cases, some local communities have donated money to keep them open, but that's not going to last very long. So I think if the sequester continues and Congress doesn't fix the issue, we'll start to see some visitor centers close down and maybe even some entrances to different park units close down as a result of this. But it has a huge impact.
What is the economic effect of reduced park budgets on surrounding communities?
It's huge. There are so many communities who depend on national parks being open and people having a great time there. We call them gateway communities because they're the sort of gateway. When the park system was established, it was encouraged that a lot of the visitor services would happen outside of the park units. So in many cases, you will hire a guide outside the park unit to take you in, or you'll hire a tour company to take you through a park unit. Those are all, you know, family-owned. Sometimes they're owned by, you know, different businesses, but those are business owners who are completely dependent on the quality and the experience in different national parks. So when the parks aren't being taken care of well or a visitor center is closed, that impacts people's visits and then can have a pretty damaging effect on those businesses outside of parks. And there's just the outdoor industry and the industries right out of national park units. I mean, they contribute so much to local economies. So it's really disheartening because it has a real trickle effect almost when the parks aren't doing well or aren't well staffed. It definitely, you can see the effects in local communities.
What do you see as the long-term effect of reduced budgeting for parks?
It's going to be everything from the quality of the visitor experience to impacts to local communities. Bar Harbor, right outside of Acadia National Park, they usually try to sort of have a shoulder season before the summer kicks up, but the park didn't open on time. So those businesses right outside of Acadia National Park really hurt because some of the main roads within the park weren't open. So as decisions like that continue to be made where national park units aren't sort of open on time, it's going to affect local communities. It's going to affect people's, you know, just basic visits. I mean, if the Park Service can't afford to keep the bathrooms open, they're not going to open them, and that affects people's visits. So this really does have an impact. And then all the historic structures, I mean, you think about all the places that the Park Service manages, from Frederick Douglass's house here in Washington, D.C., to the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial. I mean, we have to protect these places and keep them up. And so when we don't have the money to maintain them, you know, it's noticeable, and these places start to deteriorate.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Kristen Pringle, Director of Legislative and Government Relations at the National Parks Conservation Association. Our topic is threats to our national parks, as well as opportunities to protect and enhance them. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What do you see as the role of private versus public money in supporting parks?
Well, there is a lot of private funding that goes into protecting certain things or doing programs within national parks. So philanthropy definitely plays a role. The Washington Monument is a great example where a private donor funded half of the repair that's happening of the Washington Monument right now because of the earthquake that happened here in D.C. So philanthropy can play a huge role. Also, in holdings, which are private property within national parks, sometimes a philanthropist will come and purchase the inholding and donate it back to the park so that the park could be sort of completed. So there are many areas where donors have made a huge difference. A visitor center within Grand Teton National Park was funded mostly through donors. So it's pretty huge, but we don't do a good enough job taking all of that energy from the philanthropic community and making sure that we're protecting all of our parks by utilizing that money. And so we're actually working with several members of Congress right now on a bill that would hopefully look to match federal dollars with private dollars in order to work on, you know, everything from maintenance projects within national parks to programs for children and trail maintenance and other things like that that would enhance not only the actual national park unit, but also the experience that people have.
How receptive is Congress to funding national parks?
Everybody loves national parks and loves to fund them. I think parks are really a casualty of this point in time where federal funding is going down. It's incredible to think about it, but the National Park Service is only about 1/14 of 1% of the federal budget. So we have 401 wonderful units of the National Park System, and they take almost no federal funding to run when you look at the big picture. And they're so well loved around the country. And members of Congress know that of any political persuasion, they'll always have a story to share of a great experience they had as a kid growing up or with their own kids taking them to national parks. So funding has a real following in Congress. Part of the problem is with the reduced amount of funding and the Park Service is in a bill with a lot of other agencies, it gets cut just like everyone else. And so it's just a victim of all the budget cuts right now.
What are some other possible solutions to park funding that are being considered or worked toward?
Well, some people talk about increasing the fees that people pay at some of the entrances. Not all park units collect entrance fees, but there's some discussion of increasing those fees. Other fees that are paid, like concession fees, increasing those. Some ideas are to take some of the royalties from Outer Continental Shelf drilling and put them towards taking care of the maintenance backlog within the national park. So there are many ideas on the table right now, and we're hoping in the next year to work with Congress on implementing some of them.
Let's now go into detail about environmental threats to the parks. What are the most important environmental challenges for the national parks?
There are so many of them, depending on which park units you're talking about. I would say climate change is the most dramatic for many national park units from the East Coast to the West Coast to Alaska, just because the temperature is changing so rapidly. Wildlife habitat is changing. The water quantity is changing out west. We're seeing very dry summers. We're seeing more invasive species as a result of climate change. There are many factors that contribute and threaten the national park system, but that's probably the most widespread.
What are some specific examples of parks that are likely to be most affected by climate change?
Well, everyone hears of the traditional places like Glacier National Park, which are always highlighted as, you know, we're losing the glaciers in Glacier National Park, and you can actually go online and see pictures from even 50 years ago and the dramatic difference in that particular park. But invasive species, weeds, trees that aren't native to a specific area are a huge problem, especially along the Colorado River corridor. You can't even get ahead of it sometimes because it's such a huge problem. And the Park Service has to figure out ways to still continue to manage the park and to protect the wildlife, even with these types of issues.
How much is adjacent development affecting the national parks?
It depends on which park unit. Some of the battlefields here in the mid-Atlantic and northeast have development literally right on the border. And protecting places like Gettysburg so that people can really see what the battles were like and to be able to see the landscape and the way it was during the Civil War. Protecting that, we call it a view shed, is really hard to do when you're seeing development right on the border. Places like the Everglades where you see an aerial shot of the Everglades and you can see subdivisions right up against the border of the park. It can be pretty dramatic in some places. In other places, we're just seeing a lot of growth. Southern Utah, the St. George area, has just blossomed and now it's become a huge area for retirees and it's right near some of our wonderful national parks like Zion. So you're starting to see more and more development. Saguaro in Arizona is almost an urban park at this point in time because it's completely surrounded by Tucson and houses pretty much everywhere. So it depends on the park and how remote the park is, but there's definitely some really good examples of development getting close to the park units.
In what ways is fracking currently an issue for our national parks?
Fracking has definitely become a huge issue for national parks that have the activity, a lot of oil and gas development right outside of its borders. We just did a report on our concerns about fracking. Teddy Roosevelt National Park is literally in the center of a huge oil and gas boom in North Dakota. And when you look at our maps of Teddy Roosevelt, it's just completely surrounded by all of this oil and gas development, where with fracking they blast water to be able to obtain more of the oil and gas underground, and a lot of natural gas comes seeping out, and in some cases you can see the flares from the National Park Unit when you're standing there. So fracking, there are many concerns and possible impacts from fracking. The water that gets pushed down into the ground eventually comes back up, and so there are many concerns about potential contamination, because it's a mixture. It's a fluid mixture that goes into the ground in order to extract that oil and gas from the ground, to open up the seeps in order to get that oil and gas. So groundwater contamination is a huge issue. But one of the big things with the way the oil and gas boom is happening right now is that it's not just the isolated pad, the well pad that you see. It's actually many of them all in one area. And when you have a lot of activity like that happening right outside of a national park, that means it's not just the well pads, it's also the roads, the pipelines, and all of the trucks that are moving the oil and gas back and forth, or the contaminated water out of the area. So once you have that amount of concentrated development right outside of a national park unit, you're creating an area that wildlife simply don't want to go. Many wildlife don't want to be around trucks and cars and that type of development. So you're really hemming in the wildlife. And so we're seeing issues with antelope in Wyoming and so many other creatures that just, you know, really stay away, bird species that just stay away from these areas because of the amount of development happening outside of them. So we actually did the report in order for people to really start to understand what the different concerns are with both the development and the actual fracking itself, and making sure that the Bureau of Land Management, that administers many of the leases that are right on the edges of different national park units, you know, we want to make sure that people are aware of how that program works and how they can be a part of commenting on it.
How much control does the Park Service have over fracking along its borders?
Legally, none. The BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, actually is the agency that administers oil and gas leasing, so they're legally responsible for issuing those leases. The Park Service can object, and they can write comments, and they can voice their opinion about it, but what usually has to happen in many of these cases, like right outside of Dinosaur National Monument in Utah and Colorado, is that organizations like NPCA have to object to a lease in court and then to stop it. But there's really severe limitations on what the Park Service can do itself.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Kristen Bringle, Director of Legislative and Government Relations at the National Parks Conservation Association. Our topic is threats to our national parks, as well as opportunities to protect and enhance them. Would you also touch briefly on the issue of mining and coal plants at the borders of national parks?
This goes back to the Clean Air Act, and some of the sort of goals of the Clean Air Act were that national parks at the time and wilderness areas would be protected, their visibility and air quality would be protected as part of the Clean Air Act. And it's taken a really long time for the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, to make sure that the Clean Air Act was implemented properly. So we often call it regional haze, and the EPA, along with the states, do implementation plans to clean up the air in many of these areas. And it's been a slow process, but many coal-fired power plants have decided to retire because of the amount of pollution and visibility problems in national parks. They've decided that they don't want to put the pollution control technology, and it's just easier economically for them to retire than it is to clean up the plants. So that's what we're seeing in states like Washington State and all across the country, where we have these types of problems. But we're getting there, and You know, in many cases, the plants are putting better technology as a result of these plans, and in other cases, they're retiring. So it's moving ahead, but not as quickly as we had hoped.
Would you comment also on the threats from mining to our national parks?
Well, we recently have been very concerned about uranium mining around the Grand Canyon. About 1 million acres of national forest lands could have proceeded with uranium mining, and there was a moratorium on it. And at the time, Interior Secretary Salazar had to decide whether or not he was going to continue and sign a new moratorium for the next 20 years on it. Luckily, he did. So we dodged that bullet in the Grand Canyon. But, you know, these issues come up every now and again where it's profitable to mine in an area outside of a national park. In this case, it was uranium. But, you know, luckily there's a lot of support for not allowing strip mining and such in many of these areas. But there are places out east in Tennessee where it's a huge threat to the Big South Fork and other places where mountaintop removal is very popular. And so, you know, we just continue to work to try to make sure that the states and the federal government understands the impacts to things like mountaintop removal, where you have a lot of waste that goes right back into the streams and rivers, and they know what the impacts are so they don't damage the national park units. But we continue to fight a lot of those mining activities that have direct impacts on national parks.
What do you see as opportunities to further protect and enhance our national park system?
That's a great question. We really believe that telling the American story is one of the greatest values the National Park Service brings to the country and to all Americans. And recently, President Obama designated 5 new national monuments that the Park Service manages. One is Fort Monroe in Virginia, and another one is Cesar Chavez in California. And these park units present a wonderful opportunity to tell these amazing stories about our history. Fort Monroe was a fort for a very long time, but really a wonderful story about the Civil War era and enslaved people going to Fort Monroe to seek freedom, you know, in the South below the Mason-Dixon line, and how it became Freedom's Fortress during the Civil War. Cesar Chavez, obviously a contemporary Latino leader, that's the first park unit that actually celebrates a contemporary Latino leader, but really a wonderful way to tell the story of the struggle with the unions out in California. But part of what we would like to see is for the Park Service to bring in some more park units that tell a fuller picture of America and all of the people who live here. And in many cases, a lot of the park units that have been designated in the past are these wonderful natural features. But they're also missing pieces of our culture and history that aren't represented at all or very well in the national park system. So we would love to see a more diverse story being told. I mean, it's hard to even imagine that the national park system only has about 5% of its units celebrate women. And so they recently added Harriet Tubman. President Obama signed a proclamation to add Harriet Tubman, the area where she was born and grew up in Maryland, designated that a national park unit. So we're getting there, but we're not fully there. So I think diversifying the national park system and then also doing a better job interpreting the sites that we do have and making sure we're telling a complete story.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I always want to tell people to just go visit them. Go to nps.gov and go look for a national park unit that has always intrigued you and either get in the car or hop on a plane and go check it out. Or maybe it's right outside of your house and you know, just haven't sort of made the time to go. But we depend on people getting out there and really enjoying these places and appreciating them and loving them and being a part of the process to protect them. And so, you know, I think it's key that people continue to do that and go on our website, npca.org, and see what the issues are. Stay on top of the funding issue. If you can comment to your congressperson about the lack of funding for national parks, we would so appreciate that. But we really just want people to get more engaged in the national park. The centennial, the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service, is coming up in 2016. It's a great opportunity to celebrate these places and to get more active in these places, whether as a volunteer or telling Congress to protect them better. So we really just want people to get involved.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Kristen.
Thanks for having me.
You were just listening to Kristen Brengel, Director of Legislative and Government Relations at the National Parks Conservation Association. For more information, check on the web at npca.org. Again, that's npca.org. The Sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, Sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.